Chapter 6, Two Schools of Thought, July 1966. Not long after the Swami moved into his new storefront and apartment, he asked some of us if we'd like to accompany him to visit a friend of his. It would be a weekend trip to Ananda Ashram in Monroe, upstate New York. The ashram was run by Dr. Mishra, the friend with whom the Swami had stayed during his few months in the city. So one hot day in July of 1966, seven of us, including Jan and me, piled into the back of a panel truck for our first field trip with the Swami. He rode in a separate car. A small, thin young man named Charlie was part of the party. He was a flute player, and I jammed with him at a friend's house a few months earlier. We recognized one another and exchanged a few words. "How you doing?" I asked. "Yeah, okay. I thought I'd check out Monroe with the Swami." "Bring your flute?" "Always. Right here." He patted the small flute case. The rest of the way, we didn't talk very much. We mostly chanted Hare Krishna. Ananda Ashram was a large colonial-style house situated in a picturesque setting with green lawns and beautiful lake with ducks and geese. We were greeted by about 20 young people with whom we made friends. There were many hippie types there with long hair and tie-dyed clothes. Apart from them, there was also a large group of very conventional, conservative people who looked like the social opposites of us and the other alternative people. We, the Swami's people, sat down outside for lunch with them, Mishra's people, at long tables covered with white tablecloths. The seven of us flanked the Swami on both sides. It was the first time I'd seen the Swami hold a fork. He held it in his right hand with his middle finger and thumb European style. As he ate, I saw him begin to carefully pick things out of the salad and put them aside. When I looked closer, I saw they were little onions. I glanced at the people on either side of me, and I saw they had noticed too. We were all dutifully following him, picking out the onions as he did. That evening, the Swami led a roof-raising chanting session in the main meeting room of the ashram, which probably had once been the home's living room. Decorated in conservative earth tones, the room had French windows that looked out onto the ashram's expansive lawns. One of the members of our party played an electric organ, while an experienced black musician played a large stand-up string bass. The bass sounds took the event to a higher ground. Suddenly, in the midst of the chanting, the Swami stood up. Raising his arms above his head, he alternately crossed one leg in front of the other in a graceful swaying motion. "So that's what he meant by dancing," I thought, remembering his suggestion that there might be dancing at the love feast. As the Swami swayed, he began to move forward in a clockwise circle around the room, gesturing for us to follow. We gambolled behind him, forming a single conga-like line. The Swami continued to chant for well over an hour, and we responded, dancing to the quickening pace of the music. Several of Mishra's students stood along two walls and chanted with us. A few swayed to the beat, but they didn't dance. Not the middle-aged suited men, and not the younger hippie crowd either. Only two of Mishra's followers joined in, an Indian man and his American girlfriend. They clasped each other tightly and became increasingly animated, whirling around ballroom style. I caught a whiff of liquor. I looked at them and then at the Swami, trying to gauge his reaction to their behavior, trying to make out what he was thinking. He was watching them with an expression that could be taken either as a smile or a smirk. After the dancing and chanting ended, most of Mishra's followers, including the dancing couple, drifted out of the room. One or two of the younger ones hung back to hear the Swami speak, joining us cross-legged on the floor. "Krishna's name is non-different from Krishna himself," the Swami said. "Therefore, as soon as my tongue touches the holy name of Krishna, I am immediately associating with Krishna. So if you constantly keep yourself associated with Krishna by chanting this mantra, then just imagine how you are being easily purified from material existence. Lord Chaitanya distributed this chanting freely. Freely, but don't neglect it. Take it. Don't minimize the value because we are distributing. It is the most valuable thing of your life, chanting Hare Krishna, and it is free. If you chant regularly, you will practically find the result." In the midst of his talk, the Swami opened his eyes. He looked toward the adjoining room and almost inaudibly said, "Just see, we are chanting God's name, and he's taking it as a ball dance." We glanced at each other. Our suspicions of the couple's inappropriateness confirmed. The evening program concluded, and we all retired for the evening. Since Jan and I were the only couple in our party, The Swami had arranged for us to stay in a large room upstairs next to his. The room was a long log cabin with wooden walls, floors, and a ceiling, and a few small windows overlooking the lake and a forested hill. Some hours after we had fallen asleep, I awoke to the sound of a loud voice. "What is that?" I was foggy from sleep. "It's the Swami chanting," Jan said. "I've been lying here listening to him for a while." I groped around in the dark for my alarm clock. 2:30 a.m. We listened to his voice repeating the Hare Krishna mantra in a meditative monotone. We were amazed that anyone would choose to meditate at this hour of the day. Gradually, we slipped into sleep, almost lulled to rest by the Swami's distinctive voice. We rose early the next morning to take part in a Hatha Yoga class led by a 30-year-old woman, a follower of Mishra's. Most of the other students were middle-aged, overweight women who looked like they were using yoga as part of an exercise regime in the hope of shredding some excess fat. At 9 that morning, we gathered to hear the Swami speak in the main room at Mishra's complex. The Swami was seated cross-legged on a maroon sofa in the rear of the room. It was a bright summer morning, and the sunlight was streaming through the large windows behind him. We all sat on a large carpet in the sun, facing the Swami, while the two men in their late 20s or early 30s sat in the middle of the room, just beyond the fall of the sun rays. Like the men who watched the chanting the previous evening, these guys were dressed in corporate-looking business suits. The Swami's talk was short and to the point. "Krishna is Adi Purusha, the original person," he said. "Every one of us, humans, animals, demigods, even plants and trees, we are all individuals. So every living entity is an individual. How can the origin of every living entity not be a person himself? Therefore, Lord Brahma prays, Govinda Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. I worship Govinda, that original person from whom everything emanates. But because he is a person and I am a person, I should not think that he is like me. No. The Vedas inform us that although Krishna is a person, he is maintaining all other persons. One person maintaining millions and trillions of other living entities. He is a person like us, but he is different. He is Satchidananda Vigraha. He is a person who is eternal, who is full of bliss, and who possesses all knowledge. We die, he does not die. Our bodies are full of suffering, but his is full of bliss. So although he is a singular person, he is providing all the necessities to the different plural persons. That is the distinction between God and us. I glanced at Mishra's followers and saw them whispering to each other. I sensed tension in the air between them and the Swami. One of them raised his hand. The Swami nodded at him, indicating he could speak. He began to read a passage from one of Mishra's books. The passage suggested that liberation was achieved when the individual merged into God, just as a drop of water merges with the sea. A short way into the passage, the Swami interrupted. "Just try to understand," he said in a loud, forceful voice. "The gold ring and gold mine are of the same substance, but the gold ring can never be the same as the gold mine. We have the same qualities of God, but he has them in unlimited quantity, whereas we have only a minute portion. Do you understand?" But Dr. Mishra says, "Just answer. Can the gold ring ever become the gold mine?" Well, Dr. Mishra says here that, "Never mind. Just answer the question. Can the gold ring become the gold mine?" "No, but so, if the gold ring can never become the gold mine, how can you ever lose your individuality?" "The goal is to lose the ego." "The false ego, yes, but your real ego, your real identity, that can never be lost. Our real identity is that we are servants of God. That ego, that identity we don't want to lose. It is our eternal position." I thought that the goal was to lose one's ego. "No, you have misunderstood," said the Swami. "It is only my false sense of identity that must be lost. We are thinking, I am American, I am Indian, I am man, I am woman, I am black, I am white. This is skin disease. I am actually a servant of God, and that can never be taken away." "But can't we serve him as liberated beings merged into infinite existence?" "How is that service? Can you serve your mother by returning to the womb?" "Of course not, but..." "Well, how can you serve if you merge?" "Well, what I mean is that there is a form of service in oneness." "That is nonsense. How can you serve someone if you are one with him?" There was silence. I felt uncomfortable that such a heated debate was going on, that the Swami was challenging Mishra's teachings. The two men excused themselves. They said they had a meeting to get to and left us alone in the large room with the Swami. "So what do you think of Dr. Mishra's viewpoint anyway?" asked Charlie. Swami replied, "Once Dr. Mishra asked me, 'Swamiji, can God become a snake?' I answered, 'Why not? God can become anything. If he wants to, he can become a snake. Who can stop him? Certainly he can become a snake.' Then Dr. Mishra said, 'Then you are my guru.' We all stood and left the room. 'I think it's time to head back to the city,' I said to Jan. 'Yeah,' she agreed. 'I feel close to the Swami out here in this place, but the atmosphere somehow doesn't feel right. It's not like at the temple. I mean, it's beautiful here, but it's so isolated. What are you supposed to do out here?' On the way back, I talked to Charlie about the weekend. 'The Swami really pushed his point on those guys,' I said to him. 'He's not just a teacher, he's a fighter. He really didn't like Mishra's philosophy, did he?' 'Maybe, but I heard that the Swami and Mishra are actually good friends,' Charlie said. 'They disagree on philosophy, and they argue like that a lot, but they are still good friends.' 'Yeah, but that scene out there was just plain weird,' I said. 'They represent two different schools of thought. Mishra is an impersonalist who thinks we should merge into God, but the Swami is a personalist. For him, God is a person, and so are we, and our purpose is to serve him.' Charlie seemed very knowledgeable. 'The Swami told me it's an age-old debate,' he said knowingly. Then and there, I rejected impersonalism as a philosophy for my life. I realized I needed to read more to increase my knowledge. My knowledge had to be increased about the Swami's teachings so I could really know what it was all about and talk to others about it knowledgeably.